Welcome to the Economic Rockstar Podcast with your host, Frank Conway. Connecting brilliant minds in economics and finance.
Hello, Economic Rockstars. In this week's episode, I welcome David Robinson-Simon, author of Meatonomics. We explore the hidden truth behind the meat and dairy industry, and David expresses his concerns through concepts and economics. Economic themes explored in this episode include negative externalities, subsidies, and quotas. And as an added bonus, David gives us some recipes on how to eat and drink healthily. David's book, Meatonomics, is an absolutely fantastic read for anyone that's new to economics or are currently undertaking or have an interest in economics. And I am offering this book to a lucky Economic Rockstar listener. And all you have to do is visit economicrockstar.com/giveaway. GIVEAWAY. Enjoy this episode with David. And why not subscribe on iTunes and never miss an episode of Economic Rockstar. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Animal food producers are essentially dumping their garbage in our parks because they are externalizing the vast majority of their production costs onto consumers and taxpayers. For every $1 of animal foods sold at retail, there's another $1.70 in externalized costs that is imposed on society. I just think it's so bizarre that our governments are engaged in marketing to its own citizens to get them to buy products that the clinical research shows are actually damaging our health.
Hi, Frank Conway here, and you're listening to the Economic Rockstar Podcast. I am so honored to have David Robinson-Simon join me today. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Dave is a lawyer and advocate for sustainable consumption. He works as general counsel for a healthcare company and serves on the board of the Animal Protection and Rescue League Fund, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting animals. He received his BA from UC Berkeley and his JD from the University of Southern California. Dave is the author of two books, the first, New Millennium Law Dictionary, a full-length legal dictionary, and the second, which is the topic of today's conversation, Meatonomics. He lives in Southern California with his partner, artist Tanya Marie, and their rabbit tortoise and two cats. Dave, taken straight from your website.
Oh, yes.
And I mentioned there you live with some animals, rabbit, tortoise, and two cats. So obviously you have a passion for animals and you're quite an activist in terms of their protection.
I do. I do care about animals. And that's what got me interested in the topic and the book in the first place.
And Meatonomics, the title Meatonomics, How the Rigged Economics of Meat and Dairy Make You Consume Too Much and How to Eat Better, Live Longer and Spend Smarter. It's a fascinating title, one that captures an audience, I suppose, which is quite widespread in terms of those who are carnivores or herbivores or no matter what diet they actually take, paleos and so on. They would be quite interested in this. How did you get into or why did you write Meatonomics?
Well, as I mentioned, and you noted from my bio, I am interested in animals. About, I guess, now 7 years ago, I sent an email to a bunch of friends which had a video in it of conditions on a factory farm. And I asked everybody who got the email to watch the video and let me know what they thought about it. And I got back sort of a wide range of responses, you know, the whole gamut, I suppose. But the one that really interested me the most was from the dean of a law school who wrote back and said that the activities that he saw in the video were disturbing, but that in his view, they were illegal and that that meant that they were essentially irrelevant. They didn't rise to the level of a systemic concern. And that was a really interesting response. And at the time, I didn't actually know if that was accurate or not. Although, you know, I'm a lawyer and I have access to some legal resources, so I thought I would find out. And I started looking at the question, what legal protections exist for farm animals in the United States? And it turns out that the answer is the same, not only for the U.S., but for most Western countries, including the U.K. And the answer is there are very, very few legal protections for farm animals. We've got anti-cruelty statutes in place, but typically we carve out an exemption for farm animals, and we say that farm animals can be treated in almost any way conceivable that is expedient and economical. So going through this sort of research led me to understand that this industry has a unique set of protections that give it valuable economic benefits, and that sort of got me to looking at the whole thing from an economic perspective.
When you mentioned there that they have to treat animals that are most economically efficient, that obviously comes down to the standards that farmers actually set themselves, or is this something that's already within the regulations that exists?
Well, that's a really good point. What we find typically in most industrial countries is that the farming community itself that ultimately sets the standards for what is considered humane treatment of farm animals. Let me give you an example of how this works. In Connecticut, in 1854, the Connecticut legislature adopted a very broad anti-cruelty statute that said it's illegal to engage in an act of cruelty toward any animal. You can't get any broader than that. But 150 years later, just a couple decades ago, the Connecticut legislature adopted what is called a customary farming exemption. They carved out a huge loophole in that statute. And now the way that statute reads, it is legal, literally, to intentionally maim, mutilate, or torture an animal, provided that the act is done while following generally accepted agricultural practices. So what that means is if Farmer John starts to chop off his pig's testicles, for example, and Farmer Bill and Farmer Mike see that and they start doing the same thing, eventually that becomes a generally accepted agricultural practice. And what has happened is the farmers themselves have set the standard for what constitutes cruelty to animals. They've taken that standard-setting capacity away from the legislature and they've done it themselves.
So you have your legal background and you've obviously identified that this whole industry is completely ring-fenced and protected from the legislator. So economics is the alternative way for you to actually address these problems, both on a humane level of treatment of animals, but also for our own human benefit, that we should actually be aware of what's actually going on from a health perspective, but also from an economic perspective. So you mentioned in your book about the externalities that exist, which is a technical term in economics. Could you explain what you mean by externalities and how it applies to the agricultural industry?
Sure. It's a technical term with a pretty simple meaning. If I take my garbage to the front of my driveway and I leave it there for the garbage service to pick up each week and I pay them to do that, I have internalized my garbage collection costs, and most of us would think that that's appropriate. I generate the garbage, so I pay to have it picked up. That sounds like it makes sense. On the other hand, if I get in my car and drive over to a local community park and I dump my garbage in the park, I've forced somebody else to incur the cost of picking up that garbage, so I've externalized my garbage collection costs. And I argue in this book that animal food producers are essentially dumping their garbage in our parks because they are externalizing the vast majority of their production costs onto consumers and taxpayers.
And an example of one of these costs would be the emissions and the pools of manure and so on.
Yeah, so that's one great example. There are huge environmental costs associated with producing animal products, and they include things like damage to soil, erosion, pesticide use, fertilizer use. Pesticides and fertilizers often run off of soil and end up in waterways where they cause damage to ecosystems, they cause algal blooms. There are things like diminution in real estate values. If real property is located near a factory farm, research shows that it's actually going to be worth less than if it were located somewhere else. There are costs associated with climate change mitigation. There's a variety of research now that shows that animal food production is responsible for some portion of climate change. And depending on which study you look at, those studies claim that it's responsible for anywhere from 51% down to, say, 14%. But at any at any level, it's a significant number. And these costs, which are typically have been discussed in published peer-reviewed journals, add up to a significant figure. In the U.S. alone, I've calculated that just the environmental externalized costs of animal food production are about $37 billion.
Wow. That's a lot of cleaning up. And who bears the brunt of all this cleanup? Are the taxpayers?
Some of these externalized, I like to think of externalized costs sort of like if you buy a car on like a no payments plan so that they let you drive it away today and you don't have to make any payments for 6 months. What's happening in many cases is that damage is being done and costs are being incurred, but we're not actually paying it yet. It's a deferred cost that it's recognized in conventional economics, and it's probably going to come back to bite us at some point down the road, but we're not paying it yet. For example, the climate change mitigation costs, we know that it would cost not very much, maybe $9 billion or so in this country to mitigate the cost of climate change, but we're not doing it right now. However, because we're not doing it, we're allowing climate change to proceed along a path, which is going to mean that it will cost us more later to control those costs.
You mentioned about climate change, and you gave an analogy of a car as well in relation to the externality. Car emissions seem to be a very prominent contributor to greenhouse emissions or carbon dioxide emissions. But with the ever-increasing demand and supply for meats, we have problems that are pretty much generated from the growth of the cow population.
Yes. And there's certainly no question that transportation is a leading cause of the emissions that contribute to climate change. But one of the interesting calculations I come up with in the book is that if we were to reduce our consumption of animal foods by, say, 40 to 45%, that would have the same effect on the emissions that drive climate change as if we were to garage all of our motor vehicles and motor vessels during the entire time that that reduction in consumption is in effect. So you can see that reducing consumption of animal foods because of the many, many ways that they impact emissions could have a tremendous effect on helping to control or even reverse climate change.
And another thing you pointed out was the amount of water that's actually required to produce, say, a ton of beef. And you are living in California, which has been experiencing drought. And the governor, I think, has been encouraging people to actually take shorter showers. And that's not going to save the environment, or that's not going to alleviate the drought problem.
I live in Southern California, where the drought is probably as bad as it is anywhere in the state. The city where I live has adopted restrictions that say you can't water your lawn more than twice a week. You can't use water to clean surfaces. You have to sweep surfaces. There are all kinds of restrictions. And even neighbors are getting into leaving notes on each other's gates saying you're using too much water. I mean, it's a heck of a situation. Here's an interesting statistic. During this drought that California has been in, we are missing about 40 trillion gallons of water each year. In other words, that's how much rain would normally fall in a good year, but that simply isn't falling. We're missing that much water. That's about half of the amount of water required to produce all of the meat that Americans eat each year. So obviously, if people stop eating meat, that doesn't automatically make it rain more, but it does mean that if people were to cut down on their consumption of meat, that the scarce amount of water we are getting from limited rain that we are getting could be used for other purposes rather than raising the crops to feed beef cattle.
This has huge economic implications as well, because when we're talking about the externality and imposing that onto people who may not directly be consuming beef, you don't have to be a consumer of beef to impose these externalities on you.
Yeah, there's also a major concern with antibiotic-resistant infections like MRSA, M-R-S-A, which stands for something like methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aurelia, but I like to call it MRSA. But there's evidence to show that originates in livestock and spreads through the distribution of animal foods, and that because of the antibiotic use in livestock, that people are challenged to find antibiotics that can actually resist that disease. But, you know, you raise another interesting point, and that's that these externalities apply to everybody. You know, one of the calculations that I've come up with in the book is that for every $1 of animal foods sold at retail, there's another $1.70 in externalized costs that is imposed on society, everybody. So that, for example, every time McDonald's sells a Big Mac for $5 US, there's another $8 imposed on every single person, essentially, in this country, whether they eat Big Macs or not, whether they even eat meat or not. You know, I don't eat Big Macs myself, but every time that cash register brings up a $5 sale, I'm bearing part of that $8 cost, and I'm not happy about that.
Just to slightly break away from this, you don't eat a Big Mac. I'd love to know, Dave, what would your typical diet be on a daily basis? Or what did you have for breakfast today?
Let's see. Today for breakfast, I had some tea. I had a whole wheat cranberry blueberry muffin. And then I had a smoothie. My partner, Tanya, is the greatest smoothie maker. She makes us these fruit and kale smoothies with some flaxseed and cinnamon and cacao each morning that are just delicious. They're packed with protein and antioxidants. They're raw, and of course, they're vegan. But I eat a lot of fun foods. I like to enjoy my food, so I eat a lot of pizza. I eat burgers. I'll give you an example of what I had for dinner last night. We had a portobello mushroom, big mushroom top burger with vegan cheese, vegan bacon, jalapenos, tomatoes, onions, all on a bun. And that was just delicious. And no saturated fat, no cholesterol, and no animals had to die.
Sounds very tasty, you know, infused with a lot of those different flavors. I never try cinnamon or cacao in my own smoothies now. I struggle. I love having kale juices, but I think it needs that extra thing. So I think I'll try some of that myself.
Yeah, I recommend that. It adds a little kick to it.
So just going back to the price of the Big Mac, the external costs that are imposed on it, the further $8. Obviously, McDonald's, and I won't single out McDonald's, but any beef or any other meat that's actually produced has that external cost. So why are these companies not charging us more for the price of the product? Are they being subsidized significantly by government?
Yeah, so there are a couple of factors at play that allow companies to externalize those costs and not include them in the retail prices that they're charging them. One factor is heavy subsidies. In the U.S., we subsidize our animal food industry with about $38 billion payments each year. To put that number in perspective, that is about half of what we pay in unemployment benefits every year to all of the unemployed workers in this country, and where we have 320 million people. So that's a big number. That's a big handout that we give industry. But
sorry, I don't mean to cut across you, Dave.
Yeah.
Some people could counter argue and say only for the subsidies you'd have higher unemployment, because this industry does create employment in itself. Obviously, we're taken away from others too. And what would you say to that?
Well, that's a frequent argument that's raised. Anytime that there's a suggestion that subsidies be reduced or that other regulatory action be taken against animal food industry, the industry says, well, you know, we employ a lot of people, you're going to affect jobs. My response is that if we were to shift production from, well, let me back up a step. If we reduce subsidies and other mechanisms that tend to lower the retail prices of animal foods, the result would be to also lower consumption of animal foods, because as we know, if prices go up, consumption is going to come down. And because people are going to still need to eat, that just means they're going to get their protein from different sources, in other words, plant-based sources. So what we would see would be a shift in production so that plant-based agriculture would actually be in a position to hire more workers. And yes, it's true, we might see factory farms that raise animals might have to lay some people off, but I think that in the long run, those people could find jobs in plant-based agriculture.
I'm sure plant-based agriculture is being subsidized too, but maybe not at the extent that the beef industry has. I'm sure the beef or the meat industry have a very large lobbying group in Washington, D.C. and in other places.
The animal food industry in this country is subsidized by about $38 billion, whereas the fruits and vegetable industries are subsidized with only about $17 million. So it's a tiny, tiny fraction of what animal foods get. And yes, there are massive lobbying efforts at work. But one estimate has over $100 million a year being spent by animal food producers lobbying state and federal lawmakers.
A lot of research does exist that counters that we are actually discussing here, in that the beef doesn't actually contribute to higher cholesterol, that eating meats is good for the economy. But a lot of these studies are sponsored by agencies that have a direct interest and a conflict of interest, really, in terms of having these studies support their own industry. And I'm sure a lot of the people who are part of the USDA and the FDA and other groups in Europe also are actually contributing towards expanding this industry. And we see the impact that has on the rainforest. 90% of the rainforest has been destroyed in order to farm animals to provide for protein for human consumption.
That's right. There's about 3 acres per minute of rainforest being destroyed, and at least 2 of those 3 acres is dedicated to providing grazing land for beef cattle or to growing feed crops like soy and corn to feed to beef cattle.
And it's so ironic because the trees are there in order to produce the oxygen and soak up all these carbon emissions. And the depletion of these natural ways of cleaning the air is being overwhelmed by the amount of emissions that are being produced by animals.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I'm concerned in Ireland, particularly about the recent, I'm not sure if you're aware, about a recent announcement of the removal of milk quotas. We have milk quotas and it kind of fines that milk producers in Ireland are actually go over a certain quota, they get fined. But that has been restricted now. And it's expected now that we're going to be producing 2 billion litres of milk extra per year by the year 2020. With the removal of this, and there's going to be an extra 300,000 cows in the national herd, bringing it up to over 1.3 million. Dairy farms are going to get smaller and smaller because these farmers are going to start cannibalizing other farms in order to have more cattle and so as to be bigger. And this only relates to what has gone on in the United States of late over the last number of years.
Yeah, well, I'm really sorry to hear that. I'll share our experience in the U.S. You know, a quota system is essentially a way of managing supply. And in this country, up until the 90s, we used supply management to stabilize prices for animal agriculture. When Ronald Reagan was president, he was a conservative who was in favor of free markets. And his administration did away with supply management on the theory that if you simply try to let the agricultural markets regulate themselves, farmers will do the rational thing, they won't produce too much, and prices will reach their natural level that way. Well, the unfortunate result is that individual farmers continue to think for themselves, and without supply regulation, they continue to produce too much. And that tends to drive prices down, particularly where production exceeds demand. And I'm concerned that what you might see in Ireland is farmers who increase production will not see their incomes go up significantly. And in fact, they may even see their incomes go down because prices will probably drop if demand does not meet supply. And you may have a situation where you have to subsidize those farmers. That's what we ended up having to do here. That's one of the reasons we subsidize crops like corn so heavily. In one statistic I talk about in the book, I think in 14 out of 15 years in this country, because we did away with supply management, corn farmers were raising corn even when it was unprofitable to do so. In other words, in 14 to 15 years, the price of corn was less than it cost to raise that crop, and yet they produced it anyway, mainly because the subsidies were there to support it.
And these low prices that ensue based on the oversupply in the markets, if demand isn't met there. My conspiracy theory is that we're out there to export a lot of this milk, especially with the growing demand in China. We're kind of well renowned for a lot of our food products. But a lot of this could encourage more consumption and more demand. And even the government here in Ireland, and I'm sure it's the same in the United States, has clever marketing campaigns to try to encourage us to consume milk. We have sports athletes, rugby players and so on, they're consuming milk and they have the milk mustache. You know, so a lot of these are out there, and there a lot of kids are looking at it as a way of inspiring to be like these people. And the only way to get there is to bulk up by consuming a lot of the dairy.
Yeah, we've got the same programs here. The dairy spending is unbelievable. In one recent year, dairy programs who are overseen by the federal government spent almost $400 million advertising their product to American consumers. And for example, that means, among other things, they spent $50 million promoting milk and dairy in American schools, and they reached something like 35 million school children. And just as you say, when kids see those milk mustaches on the athletes and they're told, you know, you have to drink milk if you want to grow up big and strong, for which, by the way, there's no clinical support, they increase their consumption of milk and dairy. And, you know, in this country today, one in three teenagers is overweight or obese. There's some causal connection that the literature shows between those high levels of overweight or obesity and consumption of milk and dairy and other animal products.
You have a startling statistic here from your Meatonomics Index of 40 numbers that tell a story. You have a factor by which U.S. per capita consumption of chicken and other meat exceeds world average is 3, and by which U.S. incidence of cancer exceeds world average is also 3. So there are almost, as you mentioned, there seems to be some degree of correlation between the consumption of meats and the incidence of cancer.
Yes, indeed. The clinical literature is quite clear on that point. In fact, there was one study that I reference in the book that shows that perhaps as much as one third of all cases of cancer, particularly in the West, are attributable to a diet that is high in meat and dairy.
And the marketing campaigns that the governments have, they seem to be quite effective. There's quite a decent multiplier effect in terms of for every $1 spent, you have a very large amount. I think it's $9 in terms of sales being made, or even greater, that you actually pointed out.
Yeah, these programs are incredibly effective. In this country, we call them checkoff programs, which is sort of an inaccurate name. It stems from a time when they were voluntary, and if you were a producer, you could check a box if you wanted to contribute. Today, they're not voluntary. But yeah, the average return on every, say, $1 collected through these programs is at least $8. So, you know, in a typical year, we spent $557 million on these programs. And the programs themselves, who are overseen by our Department of Agriculture, say that the increase in sales was about $4.6 billion.
And are consumers manipulated at an unconscious level to be buying these products?
Yeah, that's really one of the main themes of my book. I think that animal food producers are using their ability to deliver products at very low prices, prices that I argue are artificially low, to manipulate consumers to get them to buy much more of these goods than they would otherwise. So to take the Big Mac example that we talked about earlier, a Big Mac might cost $5 in this country at retail, but if it included the externalized cost and was actually $13, people would buy a lot fewer Big Macs than they do. Economists sometimes look at a market and they're interested to know, is this a demand-driven market or is this a supply-driven market? In other words, is this market driven by consumer traits and behavior? Is it driven by things like disposable income and consumer desires? Or, on the other hand, is it driven by producer behavior, and particularly pricing? And I think for a long time, the conventional wisdom has been that consumers want their meat and dairy, and that is what's driving these markets. And that is why, for example, in this country, demand for meat has doubled in the last 100 years. We've gone from about 100 pounds per person per year to just under 200 pounds per person per year. And so people look at that and say, well, it's a consumer-driven market, and we, the producers, we're just meeting that demand. But I think something different is happening. I think this is actually producer-driven market. It's a supply-driven market. And that is because producers are keeping prices artificially low, and they're engaging in other behaviors I talk about in the book that are diminishing the ability of consumers to actually make informed and independent decisions about how much meat and dairy to eat.
Dave, was there any influencing book or person that you actually drew some inspiration from that got you to write Meatonomics?
Boy, that's a really good question. I think it goes back to the ethical reasons that drove me to go vegan in the first place. And those are the treatment of farm animals in factory farms. We've gone from a system in this country and in other Western countries where 100 years ago, animals lived on farms. In fact, most people lived in rural communities. And in fact, most economies in the world at that point were agrarian-based economies, perhaps 150 years ago. And we've completely transitioned from those sort of agrarian economies where animals were raised humanely. We saw them all the time. We saw that they were treated well, to systems where we never see the animals that we eat. They're raised in farms. They're kept in factories. They're kept invisible. We don't know how they're treated. On a regular basis, these undercover videos come out that show that they're being treated incredibly badly. And for me, it was really the recognition of that sort of change in circumstance and the underlying economic forces that made this book interesting.
I saw a documentary based on Temple Grandin. I think that's their surname, Temple Grandin. And it was absolutely eye-popping. And how Temple herself, who was an autistic girl growing up, but she's focused on the humane treatment and finally the humane killing of animals. And she's figured out systems and she's still actively trying to promote this type of work. I personally tried myself and failed to become vegan, but I've left out a lot of my products that I'm actually had once consumed. I'm not making any excuses, possibly I am. It must be easier to be vegan in California, where you have a large cohort of people and suppliers and restaurants, etc., that are more populous than it would be in other Western countries like Ireland, who are actually way behind in terms of being able to buy these products.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think it is difficult to go vegan, but it's only difficult in the same sense that it's difficult to learn how to drive a car or ride a bike. And that is to say that, yes, there's an initial learning curve and there is some initial experiential challenge. But once you've gotten over it, I imagine that every time you go out and hop in your car and drive somewhere, you don't think to yourself, boy, this is really hard. The first time you did, when you were 16 years old, you might have thought, boy, this is really hard. But it's sort of the same for me. I've been vegan for more than 7 years now, and I just don't even think about it anymore. And I think that that's probably the way most vegans in any country approach it. You know, here there are certainly some stores where we can get some vegan products that you might not have available. But I'll tell you what, you know, just a basic portobello with ketchup and tomato and relish on a bun is a delicious piece of food. And you can have some French fries on the side, and that's a delicious vegan meal right there. So it's actually, I guess it's not as hard as it seems.
No. As well as that, we only need 2,000 calories on average to get through the day. But people, as you mentioned, are probably over-consuming based on the need to have certain products. And there's always diets that exist. And the most infamous one lately now is the paleo diet, which is contributing to huge demands for meat. But I know you were speaking to Rich Roll. I listened to Rich Roll's podcast. And again, he's an athlete who is proving that you do not have to be a meat eater in order to get your protein. You can actually use a plant-based diet in order to get enough protein to get you through a sports program.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, one of the things that I quickly stopped even thinking about when I went vegan was my protein. I think we're sort of focused on protein in the West, and we're raised to be worried about how much of it we're getting. But in fact, if you think about the animals that we're actually eating, like cattle, they get all their protein from plants. They eat grass or grains, depending on whether they're, you know, raised in a factory or organically. But, you know, the biggest animals that we can think of typically are developing all of that muscle mass just from eating plants. So it's certainly not challenging to do that.
And look at the gorilla.
The gorilla, the rhinoceros, giraffe, hippopotamus, they're all vegan.
Dave, do you have any personal habits that you'd love to share with our listeners?
In terms of diet or lifestyle? Or
lifestyle. I'd love to know lifestyle, because you appear to be a very much energetic guy. You have a lot of work going on, and not only in your legal profession, but you run a blog as well, and you keep us up to date in terms of what's going on in the animal industry, and you're an advocate for animal protection. So I'd love to know, is there something that you need to do, like meditation or anything else, that you have a certain routine that you actually could not do without?
Well, I will say that for me, simply changing my diet to a vegan diet has been one of the best things that I've ever done. When I did that, I was overweight, had a body mass index that was at the threshold for being overweight. I was suffering from high blood cholesterol levels that were always over 200 milligrams per deciliter, which is the heart attack risk level. I had acid reflux, also known as GERD. I had all these problems, and I didn't actually go vegan to address them. I went vegan because of the ethical issues that I told you about earlier. But after I did go vegan, I noticed that these problems went away. My weight dropped by about 15 pounds. The acid reflux has gone and has never come back. And my cholesterol went from about 220 down to, it's been as low as 140. I think now it's at about 150. It fluctuates a little bit depending on how many French fries I'm eating, but it's at a safe level. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I do every day is I do some yoga in the morning. So I stretch, and because I spend most of my day sitting at a desk, and I want to avoid back and neck issues, I think that helps me a lot. But it also kind of helps me focus and center and, you know, think a little bit about what's going on that day.
Do you think you'll have a follow-up on Meatonomics? Because I know you've written extensively on pain that animals, even crustaceans, suffer. I'd love to see a body of work that actually talks about this and shows the research has actually gone into it.
Yeah, I'd love to write another book. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And it took me over 3 years to write this book, but I do have some ideas. You know, looking at animal suffering is certainly one thing that interests me a lot. Another thing that I'm interested in is these checkoff programs that we were talking about earlier, because I just think it's so bizarre that our governments are engaged in marketing to its own citizens to get them to buy products that the clinical research shows are actually damaging our health. I think there might be also a book there that looks at that phenomenon.
And I can see sometime in the future the swing toward the way the tobacco industry has actually undergone, in terms of assuming that smoking was actually quite healthy and good for you. And old-fashioned advertisement had doctors smoking their cigarettes, and now there are cases whereby we know, based on the research, eventually, that smoking does cause damage.
Yeah, I mean, those old 1950s ads are just amazing, you know. 4 out of 5 doctors recommend Camels to their patients who smoke, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as you point out, eventually, the clinical research showed that smoking is not good for us. And perhaps more importantly, as a result, plaintiffs were able to recover damage awards against tobacco companies. In this country alone, in the last several decades, Big Tobacco has paid more than $400 billion to state attorneys general who have sued them over medical costs. And I think in the next few decades, we'll probably see some successful lawsuits like that as well, that will target the animal food industries for medical costs related to eating those products.
Quite recently in Ireland, it's actually made a headline news here. A group calling themselves Lobster Liberation stormed into a Chinese restaurant in Dublin and removed all the lobsters from live lobsters from a tank and set them free. So I was quite impressed, to be honest. There were young people, and I love when people actually go out, hopefully not cause damage, but when they pretty much wear their heart on their sleeve.
Yes, I love to see that. And in one of the other hats that I wear as a lawyer is that I provide legal help to people like that, who either have gotten themselves into trouble and need to get out, or they're looking for legal support to do an action like that. And in fact, I've even been part of activist teams who have done similar things here in this country. We used to, actually it still exists. There's this game involving a lobster. It's like a vending machine that's got a tank of water in it. Live lobster is crawling around, and the player can put in like $2 and then manipulate a large steel claw to try to grab a lobster, put it in a bucket, and then they get to take it and eat it. And we've targeted those machines over the years. We've gotten them taken out of a lot of restaurants and bars. So as crazy as it sounds, I can certainly relate to that kind of action.
Wow. Wow. Do you have any recommended books that you'd love to share with our listeners? For one, I recommend Meatonomics, because I truly believe that anyone that's taking an economics degree at undergrad level or postgrad should read this. But this is also for the mainstream. And I think, really, hats off, this explains a lot of economics concepts within a comfortable surrounding with a real life example. So I would have that recommended as my book. And to be honest, for any listeners that are out there, I'm going to have a competition where you can actually win a copy of Meatonomics. So listen later on and I'll instruct people on how they could win a copy of this book.
Well, that's fantastic. And I appreciate the recommendation. And I do think the book provides a good overview of the issues. A couple of other really good books in this area are, one is by Colin Campbell, who wrote the book, The China Study. Mm-hmm. And this is really probably the leading piece of clinical information on the differences between an animal-based diet and a plant-based diet. He, in his career as a scientist, has done a lot of research, like hundreds of studies that he's been involved in. And he finds over and over and over again that when you feed animal protein to an animal or a person, that if that animal has tumors, those tumors are likely to grow. And conversely, if you take them off that animal food diet and put them on a plant-based diet, those tumors are likely to shrink. And for anybody who has ever had cancer or has a loved one with cancer, I think that the message, at least to me, is clear. And that is, you might want to try changing your diet. So that's The China Study. I think that's a great book. And for the nutritional part of this discussion, I would recommend that one.
Lovely. Do you have one final takeaway you'd like to depart with?
Well, I guess I would say I would urge your listeners to think about what they're putting in their bodies and not take for granted that certain foods are good for you just because the government is telling you that. You know, here we have these programs that say beef, it's what's for dinner. And people are bombarded with those messages and it's all they think about. It's all they see. It's on the internet. It's on websites and billboards and radio and TV. And so when they're walking around the grocery store in the afternoon, they're thinking, I got to buy beef. Well, I encourage people to rethink that formula and think for themselves, and perhaps a tasty portobello or a vegan burger or some pasta or pizza with, you know, vegan cheese or all kinds of great, great tasting options.
Dave, thank you so much for being so inspiring and for joining me in Economic Rockstar. I had a blast and I personally learned a lot from you. Share with our listeners where they could find you.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun for me as well. And listeners can find me at meatonomics.com, just like meatonomics.com. And the book is available. There are links there, and it's also available wherever books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc.
You can find all the links to Dave on economicrockstar.com/David Simon. Dave, you are an economic rockstar. Thank you for being so generous with your time.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
You're in the Hall of Fame now of economic rockstars.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'll tell you what, I think it is difficult to go vegan, but it's only difficult in the same sense that it's difficult to learn how to drive a car or ride a bike.